House of Grace, your podcast home for the big and small questions and answers of life with Sandra von Sobieski.
So welcome Dharma Bodhi, Corbjørn Martens. I'm so honored and it's such a pleasure to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much for taking time to answer some of my questions.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. Really nice to be here.
And I'm really excited to introduce you to some of my listeners who maybe don't know you. Because since I discovered you, I was so impressed by the knowledge you have, the spiritual path which you have walked for, I don't know, 30 years?
More.
More 40?
Actually, I'd have to say about 50.
50. Nice. So we really have a lot to talk to. And so if you are, I'm sorry, that's my dogs. You are, when you are for 50 years on the spiritual path, how was your first encountering spirituality in general?
You know, there are some highlights, of course. In everybody's spiritual life, you have these highlights that push you deeper into the path, give you a bigger sense of what the universe is and your purpose in the universe, etc. You know, and finally you bring it to your own realization of your own nature, and then you just enhance from there until death or rainbow light body, right? So it's difficult for me to actually really sort out when spiritual life began. People always ask, when did you begin spiritual life? And I say, God, I can't honestly remember a time when I wasn't into that and had awareness and so on, honestly. So I have some highlights. I'll tell you a highlight or two.
That would be perfect.
Okay. When I was about four or five, my mother was single and she was dating a Cherokee Indian man. And he said to me one morning, my mother was at work and he said, do you know how to pray? And I said, yeah, I learned how to pray in church, but you can show me. And he showed me how to pray his way. And I remember that being a really fundamental thing for me as a kid. You know, someone else recognized that there's spirituality and I wasn't alone in the world and there's other ways to pray. It was a big opening, you know, at five or four. And then my mother had taught me how to read quite well. By the time I was five, I could read like New York Times newspapers with about 90% comprehension, I think. So I was into spiritual books, right? Mm-hmm. So from seven on, I got into spiritual books and I was reading a lot about Taoism and martial arts and yoga at the local bookstore that my mother used to take me to when she went shopping. She'd drop me in a bookstore at 7 years old and then she would do her shopping and I would read all these books.
And she'd never buy one. I was going to ask, with seven, that's quite unusual.
Yeah. And she would never, you know, it was a safer world back then. Mm-hmm. You could just leave your kid in the bookstore. Nobody would steal your child, right? So now it's different, but she wasn't neglecting me. It was normal back then. Mm-hmm. But I was in a section of spirituality and philosophy of the bookstore. And I imagine the book owners must have thought, what a strange kid, because I didn't look at any other books. And she never bought me one. But then for my birthday when I was seven, she bought me a book on yoga because I'd been practicing yoga now. And so she bought me this book on yoga and I loved it. The next really big highlight, when did I really get onto the spiritual path, like really go from being, you know, interested from past life recall to being really like deep into it? Mm-hmm. I was 13. I was practicing in a martial art hall with my master. It was one of those special kind of ancient schools where they only took 12 students and they closed the door forever. And he died not much longer after. It was amazing. And he was giving us a Kriya yoga practice that we were doing. Kriya yoga with breathing, concentration, visualization, etc. And I was doing this Kriya yoga practice, and that's when it happened. That's, I'd say, my first really strong Shaktipata was then. And I really got blown away by it. Everything opened up. And I didn't recognize my own nature. I recognized it as out there instead of that's who I am. And at that point, I just thought, okay, I've got to become whatever that is. And the funny thing is, you know, I was raised a Catholic, a real strong Catholic family. And when I received my first Holy Communion, that I think was also a very deeply profound experience for me, because it turns out that in everything I practice in Tantra and Mahasiddha Yoga, the practice of Guru Yoga is the most important. So my first real like spiritual guru, like of a Mahasiddha kind of level, was Jesus, I guess. So when I received Holy Communion, it was a big thing. I really trained and prepared for it very seriously. And when I took this little cracker into my mouth that was supposed to be his body, I felt a golden, sweet, maple syrup, honey kind of nectar just go through my whole body from my head down through my feet. And I was in bliss, total bliss, you know? And I thought all the other kids in the room were having the same, in the church, were having the same experience. But I don't know what they were having, but that was really powerful. I kind of probably did ask them or told them what happened for me, but typical to my friends, they would have just blown it off and, you know, ran right over it. So yeah, I think those two were the big formative experiences that got me on the path really strong. First communion, and then that, what happened with my master, that was just, you know, incredible, and really said, okay, I made a firm commitment that day in my mind. I said to myself, I will have this experience that happened today as my normal everyday experience of life before I die. And I just said, that will be my number one priority. Everything else will be just to feed that. So I pretty much made that commitment to the path at 13, I would say.
And how did you continue?
Well, then the martial arts led me into more Taoist reading. I read Buddhist sutras when I was 13 as well, seventh grade in junior high school. They didn't grab me so much. I thought, okay, here's some good knowledge. But reading the Buddhist sutras from the Theravadin, Hinayana vehicle of Buddhism, was a bit dry for me. It was a bit too renunciate and dry, and like the world was all nasty and terrible. And that wasn't my experience of it yet. So even though I had a pretty hard upbringing, I didn't think the world was the problem. So when I read that, it wasn't that powerful for me. So I was more into the Taoist things at that point. And the Taoist made a lot of sense to me. That was just like, I get it. I didn't know what non-dual or dual meant. I never heard those words, actually. I just knew that my Taoist teachers were showing me a way to be in the world that was bringing me closer to that feeling every day of what I had in the martial art training hall, you see. So the Taoist really filled that gap. In the meantime, I'm practicing yoga every day, doing pranayama, doing meditation. So I kind of was like a Taoist and a hatha yogin pretty full on from when I was 7 till in my mid-20s.
Can you explain what Taoism is about for people who don't know?
Taoism is the original Chinese religion. It took a lot of folk religions and expanded on that and became a very powerful way of understanding how human beings are sort of like this expression of the heavens on the earth, spirit condensing into human form, becoming thicker like chi energy and then thicker again. And that our body is populated by spirits, and that we, when we are acting in accord with nature, in alignment with nature and our own true nature, that these spirits are nourished by heavenly forces, and that we then know who we are, we know our place in the universe, and we expand spiritually. That's the true understanding of Taoism. And then rituals are used to continually reaffirm that relationship with nature and other spirits and receiving those subtle energies and so on. Later on in Taoism, there became the books that most people who are listening probably heard of, like the Tao Te Ching, which is also originally called the Lao Tzu, but now we call it the Tao Te Ching, and the Zhou Yi, and all these other, what do you call Zhou Yi? In West, they call it the I Ching. It's actually called the Zhou Yi. So later became a more philosophical version of Taoism, but early on it was all about practice in a sense of meditation and aligning yourself with the harmony of the macrocosm to realize your macrocosm and microcosm are one. Now, that's funny that we call that definition of Taoism. That's actually a definition of Tantra as well. They share a lot in common.
Yeah, that would be the next question, or the next two questions. How did you discover Tantra, and what do you think? Do they have in common?
I love how Deutsch people say Tantra. It's so cute.
it's so harsh, very, right? How should I pronounce it? Is it more like...
No, I like that, actually. I like that. That gives it a bit of juice. I like... takes it out of that dry philosophy stuff. How did I get to Tantra? Well, so when I went off to, well, I was in high school, I studied Western mind control, a very deep system at the time. It was called Silva mind control. And that gave me siddhis, actually. I had all kinds of magic powers, and I thought, this is quite fascinating.
What kind of magic powers did you have?
Well, they have a test for this program. On the last day of the course, it was a month-long course, you had to have an envelope with a person's name in it and their location and their age. Then you had to go into a psychic state and diagnose the person accurately, medically diagnose them. And, you know, I was blown away that I was getting everyone 100% right with the name of the disease, what was wrong in the body, details with cells and tissues and lab tests and stuff. And, you know, they showed me all of the diagnostics on the person after each one, after actually all of them at once. I did three in a row, and then they showed me all three afterwards, and I was blown away. The teacher was blown away. They were perfect. So that kind of stuff happened. And other things, it had a lot to do with health and healing, actually, back then, the cities. There was also some psychic stuff. Like, I could start to hear what people were thinking, and that was kind of interesting. The other thing was I could influence other people. My mother
was.
Was
it when
really,
you discovered the first time when you, was it like you were walking down the street and then out of a sudden you could hear people think, or?
I was in class. I was a kid in school, and I could start to hear what my teacher was. I was concentrating on my teacher. Mm-hmm. And I could hear my teacher in class, in her mind, what she was going to say next and what she was going to do next and what she was thinking. And then it became what she was thinking about other students. And this expanded and became a little bit of, it would come and go. You know, if I really was like concentrating on something and forgetting myself, then it would happen. If I was trying to make it happen, it wouldn't happen. That I remember. And then there was some healing stuff. Like, my mother was going through a really tough time and she had a lot of pain, and I would just lay my hands on her and do this thing I learned in mind control and it would go away. And that made her upset. And then she dragged me to the priest because she thought Satan, the devil, had possessed me because I had these powers. And that was a bit of a problem for a while, mm-hmm. as you can imagine.
I can't imagine.
But anyway, that stuff. Anyway, so I practiced that. But then I went through college, university, got my degree in chiropractic. I was a doctor of chiropractic and x-ray and all that kind of stuff, CAT scan stuff. And then I went to Australia right after university. Within 6 months, I was on a plane to Australia to work and live, and I later become a citizen. There I was to contact a man that was quite extraordinary. And someone sent him to me, an astrologer I met, sent him to me and said, you need to work on my friend. He's very interesting. That's all she said. You're going to like him. So I did some hands-on healing stuff without telling him what I was doing, because I didn't want anybody to think I was one of these Reiki people who were flaky. Back then, that was really flaky stuff. And if you're a chiropractor like me, who had really kind of high professional standing and so on in Australia, you didn't do that. And I was, you know, in a medical group and everything. Anyway, I put this little hands-on stuff after I adjusted this guy's spine, and he jumped off the table and he said, at the end, he said, I know exactly what you did. And I said, what do you mean? I was just warming up your tissues, laying my hands on you, warming them up for the adjustment. He goes, no, you weren't. He said, you took energy and you put it in this channel and you brought it down to my base chakra, then you brought it up through the heart and you span it out through the arms. And he named the exact route mm-hmm. of all the energy I worked with him. And I thought, who is this guy? And I said, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm a stonemason. And what else? He goes, I teach yoga. And I said, can I come learn with you? He said, yeah, tomorrow morning, 5 a.m. And that started a year's apprenticeship with him, where I ended up, in long story short, I got rid of my chiropractic practice. I jumped in being a stonemason with him, learned every day tantric yoga with him, learned the word tantra for the first time, but in and out of one ear, you know. That was it. That was how I got into Tantra. So that's how that all started. And then he introduced me to my guru, because my first guru in Tantra was his guru.
And do you think, because you have done you have walked so many paths, like Taoism, Tantra, you were also, I think I can remember that you were telling me that you were for some month or years, maybe, with a shaman. Do I pronounce it right? Shaman or shaman?
Shaman? Correct. Shaman. In English, shaman. Yeah. So, yeah, I have a big history with that too. And I think that's what gives me a lot of grounding in my spiritual work. That's mm-hmm. in the kind of higher work, you could say, of rainbow light body practices, of the Mahasiddha Yoga and the Taoism, et cetera. Because in Dzogchen, which I love a lot, the Taoism really helped. So it turned out that I grew up in an area of Pennsylvania from 2 years old to 7 years old with tons of shamans. Mm-hmm. And our family, my great grandmother was like the major shaman of the whole county, which I thought was really cool. I learned that later. Mm-hmm. So I learned all their techniques over time, and I got more into it, because at the time I didn't know what non-duality or duality was. So I thought any kind of spirituality I should pursue. Shamanism, even though it was about healing and medicine, really, seemed to have some type of spiritual insights into the world. So I pursued it. People that pursue shamanism to be a spiritual path or to find liberation and enlightenment, that's a mistake. I got to tell you the truth, because shamanism is not about being enlightened, and it's not about that liberation idea at all. But it did give me a grounding. And then I realized later, of course, that original Taoism, original Tantra, they all brought shamanism with them into their very highly sophisticated techniques and view, and that they reinterpreted shamanism mm-hmm. into a higher thing, which they could still use. But anyway, I studied shamanism with Native Americans. I have Native American blood, and I studied with Native Americans in my East Coast area. Made a very close relationship with Thundercloud, and he took me, adopted me, and I became his grandson. So Grandfather Thundercloud helped me a lot. He was a fantastic Cherokee medicine man who lived in the mountains in New Jersey, and he did amazing healing. And this is something that always kind of bothers me about modern shaman courses and stuff. You have thousands of people signing up for these shaman courses, and mm-hmm. I'm going to offend a lot of listeners here, and I'm sorry to do that, but I come from, I'm a family shaman. Yeah, I'm a family.
Very important.
Yeah, I do too. I think I'm a family shaman from a family tradition. I trained in American Indian shamanism. I was an ayahuasquero trained ayahuasquero back in the 80s. So I was doing this way before it was cool. Mm-hmm. And a number of different shamanic traditions I studied with. Too many to list right now. So when I say shamans are healers, they're healers. They're not people who do workshops. They're not people who play a drum, smudge some sage and say, do you feel better? And a person says yes. I mean, that's nice, but you could have that over tea talking to your friend. When Grandfather Thundercloud would heal somebody, they would have cancer one day. They would come to see him, you know, hearing about him. He would do the water ceremony on full moon for them. And the next day they'd go back to the hospital and they had no cancer. And it didn't come back. And that's what shamanism was about. It's about real healing. It's incredible, right?
It's really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why I think, you know, can we please stop playing shaman, stop playing like we're shamans and let the shamans do their thing. And not every white person has to decide to be a shaman. I don't know what it is about white people.
What was, I'm just interested. Do you know what was the belief behind illness and in this tradition and of shamanism you were?
Yeah, they all over the world, every shamanic tradition mm-hmm. truly does share the same understanding of illness. And that is that we are displacing the spirits that abide in our body or the energies that we're connected to through nature. Usually they understand that we have spirits in our body. That's what animates us. And that there's spirits outside our body. And that there's a type of energy flow, many different types of energy flow that come from nature into us to nourish those spirits in our body. And that's what gives our body life and health. And when we conduct ourselves, this is the key thing. And this is the same for Tantra and Taoism, very important. Mm-hmm. When we conduct ourselves in a way that's inappropriate, misaligned with nature, misaligned with our nature, how we're supposed to align with the greater nature, we will get sick. And that is mental tensions and revenge and anger and non-forgiveness and how we're treating the planet as well. You know, all these factors separate us from our nature and from nature. And that's how we get ill, basically. In fact, I'll tell you one thing you might find interesting because I think you're into intimate human relationships in a lot of ways. I see you teaching mm-hmm. about that a little bit. So when I was in Ukraine, as soon as the Berlin Wall went down, I got over to Ukraine right away because I'd heard about shamanism there. And I wanted to see what is the original white European shamanism before it gets, you know, commercialized into workshops. Mm-hmm. So I went over there on a whim with a friend who's Ukrainian. And also I was a dancer my whole life. And I wanted to learn Ukrainian dance called hopak, very powerful dance.
I have never heard of that.
That's what people think of Russian dancing, you know, like wearing the boots and kicking out and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually Ukrainian. It actually comes from Ukraine. The Russians took it from them because Russians really had no culture back then. And Ukraine's had a very rich culture. So I went over there to learn hopak and to study ballet in the second largest ballet institute in the world and to study shamanism. So when I was up in the mountains, no running water, no electricity. People made their own clothes out of linen and cotton that they grew, which was amazing. And we got our own food, hunter-gatherer, the whole thing, mushrooms, strawberries, hunting. It was wild farming. So I lived up there on a mountain in a tent with this one gal. And we were up there for a long time. And I made friends with a local shaman. And she was just fantastic. And she was in her 80s. Mm-hmm. She had so much sexual life force energy, so much vitality in her 80s that I was like scared to be around her, you know. In fact, one morning, I remember I got out of the tent early to get up and have a pee, you know, before my day started. It was probably 5 a.m. And I saw a boy from the village that I knew down below the mountain. He was about 15. He was running out of her hut and he was like putting his pants on as he's running down the road. I thought, holy smokes, she just had some kind of sexual tantric meditation with a 15-year-old kid and vampired all his energy, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so her name was Baba Anna, and Baba Anna was really cool, and she had a lot of oracles and stuff. One day, I did my usual thing with shamans. I had a set of 20 questions I'd ask everybody. So I said to Baba Anna, Baba Anna, why? What's the nature of illness? And then she explained the definition I just told you, like they all do. That was no new surprise. And I said, okay, Baba Anna, what is the reason that people get sick, really, like in a more detailed way? And she said, well, let me tell you. Men get sick because they don't get enough sex. And I was like, what did you say? She said, men get sick because they don't get enough sex. She said, basically, she said this, if you let a man have sex as much as he wants with his wife or girlfriends or whatever, he'll never get sick. I was like, oh, all right, that's an interesting idea. I've never heard that one. I've never heard that from a shaman yet. And then I said to her, well, then why do women get sick? Obviously, the next question. And she said, no, women get sick because they don't get the right type of sex. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow. So men just need a whole bunch of it, whatever it's like, but women need a special quality of sex, you know? And that was really mind-blowing at that time. I was just getting into tantric practice in a very deep way. And I was starting to learn that there was sexualized yoga practice, sexualized meditations in Tantra, not as the main part of the path, but that it was in there. Mm-hmm. This was all fascinating to me because some of the Taoists in my practice when I was younger had a lot of Indian Tantric influence from the era of Taoism that started around 600, 700, 800 AD or CE. That's when the Indian Tantric stuff came across the mountains and started influencing Chinese Taoism a lot. So sex practices started a lot around that time and so on. So some of that was in there.
Can I ask a question? Did Anna, please. Baba Anna, tell you what kind of sex women should have? I think many of my female listeners would be interested.
Yeah, she was saying basically what we know now as real intimacy. She was saying she wanted that the women want the partner to be present. The women are not so focused on the pleasure as the primary, but that if we have real intimacy, real love, real caring, real sensitivity, real beauty in the sexuality, then the pleasure will be there more naturally for a woman. She said, look, a man can rub against a wall and have pleasure and orgasm, but women, to get a really high level of orgasm, really need to have something much more profound. And in Tantra and in Taoism, probably because the Taoism I studied the sex stuff from, I got it from the Tantra, there's these four levels that a woman should go through as she hits arousal. And they're also played up in the Kama Sutra, four ways that a man and woman should interact that slowly bring on a deeper and deeper opening of her energy body. Mm-hmm. So that the real intimacy hits all the chakra channels, everything opens. So that when she finally gets to that deeper place and she's making love, the depth and profundity of the pleasure and the love are so deeply intertwined that it becomes like, you know, a universalized, very beautiful and very powerful experience. So this is what Baba Anna was describing.
Sounds beautiful. And I agree, women would have a hard time to get sexual arousal by rubbing on a wall.
Of course, you know, it's a full spectrum with women, right? I mean, but yeah, overall.
They're a very sensitive ball. So it's very interesting because I love how you pointed out the things which have, who are like the same or similar in Tantra and Taoism and on your shamanic path. And what would you say are the maybe three fundamental things which you see in every tradition? And I also, just a small hint, I just noticed that your voice is sometimes louder and sometimes not so loud. So I think you are moving on the microphone.
No, I'm standing perfectly still. So I'm just using
really?
Too much
That's
voice.
That's strange.
Sometimes.
So maybe it's the internet connection.
Away from myself? I'll move it away. Tell me if that's better. Is that better?
I think it's okay. Yeah.
Okay. Just let me know if it gets trouble. I'll move it away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bring up my volume when I get excited, I guess.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Okay. So what was that question again? Oh yeah. The three
but
things.
Please be excited.
The three things. Well,
yeah.
The background on this is that my first Indian Tantra guru who was teaching me Shaivist yoga he made a very big point of telling me, Dharma, I am teaching you yoga. This is the yoga tradition. Mm-hmm. And I said, but Swamiji, this is so much more than physical postures. He said, oh yeah, that's nothing. You know, that's great, but it's very small part. Mm-hmm. And I later found out what I'm learning is, you know, what I would call Tantra. But later on, I studied with Tibetan Buddhists and with other more higher level Taoists and completed my Taoist training in very high level studies of Tao Dzogchen and all this kind of high level stuff. And I saw so many things that I learned in there in what he taught me, which is not in standard Shaivism. So I retroflectively thought back to when he used to explain to me, this is yoga, remember, this is yoga. And what he was saying was that what he received from his teachers was what we now call Shaivist, you know, yoga. But actually, it was highly influenced by things like Tibetan practices of meditation and yoga, Chinese practices of meditation and yoga. And even though Shaivist yoga gave over 50% of its work to Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, they came directly out of Shaivism. That's an absolute fact. Even though that happened, there was an interplay between Vajrayana or Tibetan Tantric yoga, Indian Tantric yoga, and Indian Buddhist Tantric yoga, sorry, and Shaivist yoga. That interplay back and forth over centuries added much more to the Shaivist yoga tradition, because I'm from an oral practice tradition. Mm-hmm. We don't go by textbooks that were written in 8th, 9th, and 10th century and freeze Shaivist yoga into that and think that's what it is, or think that those texts actually fully defined what Shaivist yoga was, because those are just textbooks. Mm-hmm. The real practice was coming down from practitioners, from someone's mouth to someone's ear, teaching them practices all the way down through time. And that's the real tradition. You know, I don't really pay much importance to textual tradition, actually, in Shaivism, because we have it live in the oral tradition. The oral tradition, I think, is much more powerful. So it means I'm setting up this background for an answer to your question of what are the three mm-hmm. things I think are, you know, common between all these, because when I teach Trika Mahasiddha Yoga, which is what we teach, our system, it really is such a full system. It does really cover the main points of very few systems. Now, these are the systems that we think are on the same level in the world today. You have Orthodox Taoism, but we have to let that go, because to be honest, there's really no way to learn it for Westerners. And in China, it's almost disappeared completely. Way out in the woods somewhere, you might be lucky to find it. I hear people that see people, but that's it. So Orthodox Taoism used to have this view in this practice, and whatever's left from that, I learned from my teachers, and they're all dead, and you know, so on. Shaivist yoga is another one, a non-dual tradition of yoga and meditation. But here again, I don't mean the text tradition. I mean more the oral practice tradition. Vajrayana, which came from Shaivism. This is now Tibetan Buddhism, but was Indian Tantric Buddhism, which went to Tibet and China and Japan. And then Dzogchen, which no one really knows the origin of. No one can actually say where it came from at all. No one has any idea, to tell you the truth. Everyone's mixed up on it. Scholars are arguing all the time about it. But Dzogchen has all this same root as this one I'm telling you about. And Stav, which is a Norwegian spiritual cultivation, pre-Christian, that I received as well. And studied very deeply with a master of it. And we became very close, and he actually adopted me and his family as well, which was lovely. So these systems all share the most important common characteristics. The view is the same. Many of the practices, I'd say 30, 40% of the practices are almost identical. And the rest, maybe like another 40% are similar. And then maybe there's 10 or 20% unique practices for each of those traditions. So overall, they're very, very similar, just coming from different cultures. Mm-hmm. So they sequence their practices slightly different in all these different traditions, but the teachings are the same. So what are the same? Well, I think you want to know what are the same characteristics of them. Is that right? Yeah.
And also, I would be interested if you have like three fundamental truths, mm-hmm. like the view on non-duality, which are the same.
Okay. Yeah. So. Okay. So they have this, they have one fundamental view, we'll say. Mm-hmm. This one is that we are already in our humanity. That is, these are paths of human realization. You don't become a god. We don't care about gods and goddesses very much in these traditions. Mm-hmm. Although it seems like that when you read the books. It's all about your human nature and your human nature being perfectly at tune, perfectly at one with this universe in its potentiated form. So we have to bring that potential out. So just like if your glasses are on your head and you're running around the house looking for them, the glasses are no use to you. But the glasses are on your body already. They're part of your being. You have them. Mm-hmm. The same way, we have our own essential nature. It's called different things in different traditions. Buddha nature, nature of mind, essential nature. Your svasvarupa in Shaivism mean your self, self form, things like this, right? Mm-hmm. But basically, we all are that experience already. We have it and we are it. It's unchangeable, it's unbreakable, but it needs to be revealed. Needs to be discovered, needs to be recognized. So the truth, I'll tell you three truths. Yeah, here's three truths that all these systems share. One, we have this true nature already, but we don't know it. And it's not a matter of intellectually saying, oh, I just read a book about it, I got it. It's a much deeper, more profound realization we're talking about. And that's another whole story, because I think people today believe that they're awakening and know their real nature. And because the masters are not around so much, or they're not studying with them, they don't realize they're just having an intellectual idea accompanied by some nice feelings that they think they're realized, and that'll get destroyed as soon as coronavirus comes, or the next war, or they go bankrupt, or their girlfriend walks out, or their doggy dies, you know? So first, we are that beautiful oneness with the entire universe. We are that already, but we don't know it. That's the first truth that they all share. The next one they all share is that we have to recognize that. We have to have it introduced to us. So the next truth is it must be introduced to us. Oh, and what does that mean? Introduced to us by a master who already has that waking state of transmission within them, within their experience. It's no longer just potential. It's being lived. It's a lived experience. And this again is a difference between someone who's done 30, 40 years of practice in a tradition versus if you just read a book or thought you just realized yourself. It's not intellectual. It's an embodied experience and it's radiated. So you have to know that this is your base. This experience is the base experience of all humans. You have to be introduced to the base by a teacher. All the systems I'm telling you right now, they all have introduction to this base experience by a teacher. That's why we get a teacher. That's why we form a lifelong or lives long bond to a teacher or teachers in a tradition. Because sometimes it takes more than one life for us to fully recognize that nature, that inner nature. But we can keep coming back and continue the journey at a higher level each life. Many people are doing that now, seeking out spiritual teachings. So then we are introduced to our nature by our master. And this is the greatest day of your life, basically. And the next follow on from that, the next truth is you have to confirm that truth for yourself. And that part's difficult. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will go many lives or many years saying, I'm not sure. Master gave me introduction to my nature, but I still have some doubts about who I really am. And I fall back into my lower nature and act out like a bit of a silly person sometimes still. So I think I'm not really realized yet. That's if a person has honesty, good self-reflection and honesty, which is very rare these days. Everybody wants to be realized, right? And they want it the easy way, the quick and easy way.
Yeah, so, a four-week enlightenment challenge.
Yes, exactly. All right, I went to that guy's lecture and this great teacher, you know, who talked to me, I just got realized, that's it. So you have to confirm it for yourself. And then once you have decided, the way the texts talk about it, they say you have to firmly decide that you have realized your nature. And then there's one more step, and they all share this in common too. It's not enough to just be introduced, to know your nature exists. Not enough to just have it introduced to you by a master. Not enough to just then honestly recognize your true nature. Beyond that, if we're truly going to be realized, the experience of recognition must be stabilized. So it's said in the last step is that you will continue in that realized nature. You will continue in that nature. And that's a very big one. So you confirm beyond a shadow of a doubt, and then you must confirm in that nature. And that's the tricky part. That's where people can still fall. That's where big teachers have fallen. That's where...
Did you fall?
I don't think I fell as far as ever lost my way. Like some teachers will, when I say fall, will completely lose their way and become like very bad people. And I think that's a real tragedy when that happens. And that's allowed to happen today because systems are not as strong as they used to be, where a student would be like, there's like 20 realized masters in this system. So one falls, it's obvious. And the other masters say, okay, don't go to that master anymore. He's fallen or she's fallen. So yeah. So this is kind of the process. This is how it works.
What would be your advice to when people really want to start the spiritual path?
Well, you can take what you can get, right? Because everybody starts with whatever they can get. And our karma, our positive karma, we call the karma of merit, has to build up before we're going to meet the teacher of our dreams. We have to go through life experiences. We have to struggle a bit. We have to take whatever we can from whatever teachers we're able to find at whatever level they're at, do our best with that, and we start showing up. We start accumulating a kind of positive energy. Our mind starts opening toward wider views. Mm-hmm. We start developing more critical self-analysis and self-introspection, clear self-reflection. And that's very important because it's very easy to get lost in spiritual experiences or also to have your ego just get pumped up by spiritual experiences. Mm-hmm. So as we start to go that way, in the good way, when we start to see ourselves clearly, and what we'll start to notice is that, okay, that thing I was doing, that was a good spiritual thing for a while, but it's so limited. I'm going to leave it and try to look for the next higher one. Or while you're doing some spiritual work, you notice something higher in your mind. You're like, that teacher is teaching me something that's touching me in my heart mind in a much higher way. I'm going to go with that teacher. And so we take what we can in the beginning, but then obviously what we want to do is really look into what is a really good path. And I just did a series of two classes on picking a teacher, which discusses a lot of this actually. Yeah. And I have one more to go on it, as you know, one more to go on that one.
I'd highly recommend. The links in the show notes so people can watch.
Yeah, thanks. Because it's a big question. It's the number one question I get. Mm-hmm. How do I pick a teacher? How do I know if the tradition is for real? So I think this is a really big thing. So yeah, you take what you can get and then you refine your view. And this is where reading comes in the beginning and going to lectures. But once you educate yourself well, and you figure out, okay, do I want some modern thing that someone just created, or do I want something really old that gave light body to its masters? You know, because you see, we're in this game for human realization, and there's a lot of paths that have been doing this for a long time, but not all these paths have the same fruit, Sandra. This is the same result of the path, the same end of the goal of the path is not the same for all of them. And this is what we have to find. What do we understand in our own nature to be the best, highest aim for us in this lifetime? Do I understand what enlightenment means? Do I understand what spiritual liberation actually means? Or do I just want to be a healer? Mm-hmm. Or do I just want psychic powers, right? Or do I want a rainbow light body? I've heard that some masters get so realized. These ladies, like here, example, 10 years ago, a woman in our tradition of Mahasiddhi Yoga from the Dzogchen side, so she's right in my lineage on my Dzogchen side from my teacher, she sat down at about middle age on a mountaintop, invited the whole village. This is a normal occurrence in Dzogchen in Taoism a long time ago, but still happens in Dzogchen a lot. She sat down on a mountain in a village with her teacher and gave everybody a big talk, a lecture on Dharma and being good and doing good and meditating once in a while if you can, because they're just lay people. And this villager supported her up in the mountains in her retreat for all these years. So she wanted to give them a final blessing before she disappeared. And what I mean by that is she then, after she was done, went into a little tent on the top of this hill that her teacher and she constructed. And she went through a 7-day process of transforming and releasing the 5 elements of being from her body, mind, and energy back into their origin in the universe. And when that happens, the person disappears, physically disappears, and you see rainbow light pouring out of the tent and going like in circles or spheres rolling across the ground, or clouds of rainbow light kind of traveling across the ground, or rays of rainbow light shooting out like meteors. This kind of light display occurs as the 5 elements are being sent back to their origin. And so everybody has a different goal. This is one possible goal or one possible understanding of the final stages of the human journey.
And the body is completely gone?
There are many stages of it. So in one phase of it, lots of lights come out and the body shrinks. so the body can get smaller, come down to about a meter in size, basically, like a very, very, very small person. Though the head usually stays kind of large, so it's kind of strange looking. Another one is the body will go much farther, and hair and nails are left over, and clothes. So you see hair, nails, and clothes are left over. That was one of my good friend and a person who taught me a fair bit as well. His teacher went that way in Taiwan in the 70s. That's one rainbow light body as well. Then a further level of it is the person goes in such a degree with such power that their hair, their nails, their whole body, and their clothes they were wearing disappear as well, right? Because the one before this, when a master rainbow light bodies, their robes or their clothes, whatever they were wearing, is still sitting there and the body's gone. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, a chemical reaction occurs. And mercury sulfide is found to be embedded all through the clothing as like a dark brown crust. Mm-hmm. And it's scraped off by the students and made into medicine pills during a ceremony. And I'm very fortunate to have a number of those pills in our possession here at our center. And I keep them on the altar for the blessing power. And students, when students come, I'll touch them to the centers, spiritual centers of the student's energy body through the physical body and give them a little blessing with it, you know. So that's a really nice benefit for us who are left behind. If you take one of those pills physically and eat it, it actually gives you much, much longer life and deeper spiritual practice. And it's also made into a liquid that we drink during ceremonies as well. So the third one is everything disappears. Clothes, hair, nails, there's nothing to scrape. It's all gone. And then the very last level of it is that the master can disappear. And if a student has been teetering on very high level practice and about to go over into it themselves, but hasn't been able to push over into that place, they can be catalyzed like an enzyme by the master's rainbow light body. The master can take them as well. So you hear this in the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. It's most famously about Yeshe Tsogyal, the great lady, Yeshe Tsogyal. She took many students with her when she left. And other students cried when she left that didn't go with her. And a remarkable thing that we'd never heard of before in the light body tradition was that she came back and recondensed a body again when she saw them crying. She said in her light body, she made another kind of magical appearing body and said, "Don't cry, my students. You'll get there. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just light body. I'm your essence." And she left again, which is so compassionate. So they were comforted. But her teacher, Padmasambhava, took 5 students with him. He had 25 students, 5 were able to go with him. Abhinavagupta, the great sage of Shaivist yoga from a long time ago, was supposed to have gone to a cave and took, the legend says, 1,200 students with him, 1,200. But because Indians are so hyperbolic, that means he probably took about 2 or 3. So about 2 or 3 students probably light-bodied with him. He'd love to turn everything into something unbelievable. So yeah, so this is light body.
When you first heard and maybe experienced that, did you lose the fear of death, or didn't you have a fear of death before?
You know, I had a big fear of death, very big. Oh, so strong, my fear of death. It drove me my whole life to find liberation. The spirituality and fear of death and sexuality were so tied together for me, which they are in astrology, in the 8th and 12th houses, sex, death, and spirituality all tied together. And yeah, it drove me really strongly. And when I first heard of the light body tradition of masters, I was very comforted because I actually said, of course, yes, it makes total sense, right? And then, but I had to go through this immature stage. When you hear about light body, you think, oh, I'm going to be immortal, because Taoism has immortals. So I'm like, you know, I'm a little boy already learning about the immortals. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a really new idea for me, but the idea of, you know, how it occurred, I was not sophisticated enough in my understanding when I was a little boy to know now how it occurs with channels, chakras, 5 elements, et cetera. So bindus and whatnot. So when I got older and I heard about this, I thought, oh, okay, that's great. I'll go for light body. That's fantastic, because I think I have the capacity as a yogin in this lifetime if I can find the right master. But then I grabbed onto that, as we do, as an attachment so that I could buffer my fear of death, you see. And this was a deep part of my spirituality that I didn't realize at the time I was doing, of course. And it took a lot of, I did an 18-month retreat meditation by myself for 18 months in a room. And that really brought out most of these fears that I had at deeper levels to get through them. In the first 4 months, it was, you know, people think, oh, I'm going to go on retreat and have such a wonderful time for 18 months in nature. Think again, because the first six to 12 months of that is horrific. You know, I mean, just, I really suffered. I cried so much. I mean, I'm a big, tough ex-professional fighter. And I was sitting there crying like a little baby for 4 months, because it was bringing up everything. And I thought, I don't think I have the strength to withstand this, facing the truth of myself. I'm still scared of death. I grabbed an attachment onto immortality that was immature. I don't think I have the ability to become a rainbow light body master, or even to become enlightened or self-realized. You know, all these fears came up, and I cried through them and just said, well, everything else in life means nothing to me compared to this. I already know that. So I have no way to go back. Like the famous army, whose general said to the army, turn around, look, I just burned all your ships. You either win this battle or you're not going home alive at all, you know, because they were outnumbered 3-1, famous Persian general fighting the Greeks. So, or Phoenician general fighting the Greeks. And I was in that same position, like the Buddha, when he sat down and put his hand down and said, I will get enlightened here or I will die. That was the commitment I made. So I saw all this terrible fear, you know, and I had to go through it. So when you asked me, did it give you comfort over death? It did initially, but that was false. Mm-hmm. Many years of meditation later, when I was okay with my death, you know, as okay as we can be with dying, then it changed. And I realized, okay, so, because there's actually another way, your rainbow body too, which is after you leave the physical body. So masters will sit up straight in our tradition. If they don't rainbow body, they will sit up straight if they're realized, and they will get into a yogic position and they will meditate, and they will tell the students, I'm going to die. And they'll pick a day and date and time and so forth. And they'll give them a lecture or something in that meditation posture. And then they'll say goodbye, and they'll close their eyes and start meditating. And then their heart will stop. Their brain waves will stop, but there'll be a warm spot around the heart. And this continues for 1 to 10, averages 1 to 10 days. The body will sit straight up with no blood pulsing, with no breathing going on, with no heartbeat and no brainwaves. Person's clinically dead, medically dead. And that will go 1 to 10 days, and then they will slump over all of a sudden. And that is when they've ejected the consciousness from the body at the last second, because they pull all of the different bindus together into the central bindu, and they learn how to project it. This is a very esoteric secret process. We can't talk about it. We can't talk about it. Or I'll go straight to guru hell. And so anyway, that's what my Indian master did, and that's what my Tibetan master did. Neither of them got light body in this lifetime, but they died sitting up, the death of a yogin, under full control of their consciousness. And my Indian guru picked his time of death. He was perfectly healthy. My Tibetan guru, Lama, had said he would die because he was getting sick, but he just meditated away into it anyway. So in a way, he picked his death. Mm-hmm. But my Indian teacher was super healthy and just said, yeah, I'm just tired of this and I could go another cycle, but I think this is old enough with this body and I need to do this process. Takes a certain amount of energy. So you want to, the light body process and sitting up straight dying takes a certain amount of energy. So you never let yourself go right to the end of death from some kind of illness or something. You go before that so you can do it. So this is what happened for them. So they, if you don't achieve light body while you're still physically on this planet, when you go through that process and eject your consciousness from your body at the end, then you can go through the light body process in the after death state, where you continue to dissolve all self-images, clinging to a separate sense of self, and that holds the five elements together, and that just then dissipates back to its origin.
And is there an answer, what happens to people who don't have any practice when they die?
Yeah. When they die, if they don't have any practice at all, but they die a very sweet, wonderful death, they just become recycled in a beautiful way, and that's all sweet and wonderful. If they, if they had a little bit of a sweet death and were not really suffering terribly, and their mind was able to stay open and clear at that moment of death, they can actually have some higher thoughts and higher experiences, and they might go back and join their ancestors in a kind of ancestral level of consciousness, mm-hmm. or they may even go farther into like, oh, I wonder what these lights are. Ooh, beautiful, you know, and be drawn to the lights of higher realms, like the Siddha realm, the great realm of the masters or deities and so on. So that's possible if they had no practice. It's just highly unusual, because usually if people haven't had a practice, they're usually kind of emotionally reactive, and they usually have a very strong sense of self. Self-grasping is our main problem. And when they die, when we die and we lose our bodies, our minds are just shot out into a matrix of energy and no form, so that whatever our mind is, it becomes our world instantly. It becomes our world. And we start walking around in the world of our regrets, in the world of our angers, sadnesses, you know, desires and lusts. So, oh, the one you never got to make love with. Well, there they are, all naked and ready for you, you know, and you do this and you're lost.
So much have to think about Christianity right now, because it sounds like the Christian idea of, I mean, not what I would imagine as hell when you describe.
Yeah, we create our own experience after we die. And unfortunately, we don't do it consciously because we haven't become a practitioner. We don't have any conscious ability to create this experience. So it can be horrific. And this is where the Six Realms teachings come in that I've taught around the world for a long time. And now a lot of other yoga teachers are picking it up. And this is a powerful teaching that shows one of the six ways, just one, because there's really more than that, that your consciousness and energy can take new form after you die in the after-death state. And you can get fixated for thousands and thousands of years or lifetimes even in these other realms that are kind of suffering. And yeah, this is where Christians understood hell from. They had visions of the demon realms, what we call the Rakshasa Loka, or the demon realms. And they started to see this and thought, this is where I'm going, you know, I broke the rules. And they're probably right. If you have that fear and you were a bad person and you did bad things, and you didn't make up for them, and you have fear of it, that's where you're going to go. Definitely. It's not like you're going somewhere. You are projecting that reality from your own consciousness. Mm-hmm. And you will then occupy that world of hell and suffering until you're liberated from it, right? Same thing, you could project into the realm of ghosts and be longing and haunting. And we know ghosts are real. Most of the people listening to this podcast have seen a ghost or experienced a ghost.
You helped me a lot with some unwanted visitors.
Yeah, I used to have a job.
For listeners, I'm not sure if I talked about it, but I did a ritual which I wasn't supposed to do, and it went terribly wrong. And then, like for example, lamps went on, but they were not plugged into electricity, and things would fall down, or electric devices would turn on. And you helped me a lot with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Spooky stuff, that stuff. Yeah, very spooky.
But, you know, I had at the weekend, there was an incident. My surfboards fell down out of a sudden. We have to talk about it later.
We'll talk about it. Well, you know, it brings up a really good point. Do we have a minute to talk about it?
About the surfboards?
No, about this. I wanted to talk about it if we have a minute. It's important. It's an important point you bring up. Because with modern spiritual practice, Sandra, this is a really important thing for your listeners. Let me tell you, listeners, please listen to this. I'm a traditional teacher, very traditional. Students want to study with me, they have to go from A to Z. And that's why I have very, very few students, because today nobody wants that. You want to get your yoga teacher training in 200 hours instead of 200 months. So that's the way it is. Well, that is not a good thing. And learning how to meditate outside of the context of spiritual tradition is dangerous. And learning how to do all these tantric practices, connecting to deities, chakras, channels, mantras. This is all very dangerous outside of a protective mandala that you get when you practice with a master who's realized. And this is a very important warning, caution, and advice I'd love to give your audience, because when you start to open yourself up, you don't really know what's out there.
Yeah.
You don't even really know your own energy. I mean, you're not really that conscious. You're not super conscious when you first get on the path for the first 10 or 20 years. And you need a protection mandala. All the great realized masters form a protection mandala, a mandala of great beings that protect you from yourself in the beginning, actually. So when you're first opening up channels and doing breathing and opening your mind, you're opening up into a layer of the universe that you previously hadn't opened before. You're piercing other layers. This universe is a multi-layered cake, you know, all going on at once. And what happens is it puts you in touch with other beings who actually will influence you. They will want to influence your thoughts, your actions, your motives, then they can. And they will want to eat your energy because that's what they eat for food. Mm-hmm. And if this goes on long enough, they'll possess you. They can partially possess you or fully possess you. It can go from influence to partial possession to full possession. And I see a lot of spiritual teachers around the world today that are fully possessed, right? So this is really quite scary. But when you're a basic practitioner and you first start out, I really think it's so dangerous to go with teachers who are half-baked or just, you know, taught themselves and had no guru, and you're doing these deep practices of mind and energy and spirit, because it would be like, and I want you to get this analogy, Sandra, it would be like you saying, I'm going to go into my body, cut it open with scalpels and play around like a doctor would, you know, because that's what you'd be doing, and you'd have no training and you would die. So instead, we get influenced by all these different spirits, different deities, even minor gods. Gods are not all enlightened. There are many gods who are not enlightened, and they like to mess around with people still. And they give cities, they give magical powers to people, they give great spiritual experiences, they give the person a lot of charisma, and they can teach and so forth, but the god is just using them. And then when they go to die, it's a horrific thing when you see it, and everyone realizes, oh my goodness, I thought that was my spiritual teacher, but they're actually dying in this horrible way instead of sitting up like a yogi or turning into light. So what happened? We see this in the example of Sai Baba, the guy who had the big afro on his head, the afro hair from India. When he died, the god that had inhabited him and allowed him to have all these magical powers and made him so corrupt that he performed over 2,000 acts of pedophilia, child abuse, sexual child abuse, documented. This god who was corrupted and not enlightened and made him appear so powerful and all knowledgeable. Let me tell you, I've seen the powers this guy had when I was in it back then. And I thought, I'm staying away from him. I didn't trust him at all. My spiritual BS bullshit protector was quite good back then. But I was in a mandala, you see. I was in a protective mandala already. I was practicing traditionally. When he went to die, the god left him, and his body collapsed rapidly over a number of weeks and became horrible looking. And he was in terror, and he was shouting out and crying out and in total terror, because you don't have energy left. The god ate it all, used your body. And now the demons are dragging you away. So the demons were dragging away his consciousness into the demon realm when he was still alive, and he was screaming. And oh my goodness. So it sounds like a bad movie, but you know, horror movie, but this is the truth. So I want to make a real impression on your students. It can look really good. The influence could be from a demigod or from a minor god or from a spirit that has power. You can be psychic. They give you psychic power. They can give you healing powers. They can give you spiritual experiences that feel wonderful and amazing. But you got to be careful, super careful, because we don't have the ability to know where is that energy coming from. I think it's from me, but you don't know that when you're young and beginner in all this. So go to a tradition with a traditional master like myself or somebody else who affords that type of mandala of protection. And of course, it takes the student to be trusting and devoted and surrender into that mandala. You can't just like take the initiations or study and then all of a sudden, oh, I'm in a mandala, and be full of your own ego, because then you have no protection, right? If you're full of your own ego, that's exactly what these beings are looking for, to possess you. So yeah, just a little word on that, because I used to have a job as a ghostbuster. You know, we talked about that. I used to dispossess people and dispossess houses or cars, you know, and that was my job for a while, and I really loved it because I was good at it from my shaman training. And I guess my yogi aspects of it helped me not get caught or lost by the demons or the ghosts that I was exercising. You know, I had a certain power from being a yogi and the protection mandala. So I know what I'm talking about firsthand. This is not me speculating or repeating teachings I heard from my teachers. I want people to be very careful.
And you can tell. I mean, I can tell when you are telling me all the stories. And I don't know if I have said that to you, but I have read the sentence about everything eats in a forum. And yeah. Then I got curious because I found it so profound. And also, I never thought about that. And I was like, oh my God, I never thought about it. But it just feels really true. And then I had this incident here, and this really made me very humble. And now I stay away from practices like that. And
well, you're very juicy. Teacher,
so, you know, you just gave me my practice for the next month. And I know this will take years and years and years, but I'm so fine with that.
Because we have to be okay with that.
Experiencing this once, I'm like, no way I'm going there. I'm so glad that I met you, and I'm so glad that I can practice now in a system. And especially it, I think my voice is also louder now because I get really enthusiastic about it.
Wonderful.
It was so important. So I'm kind of glad that it happened, because otherwise I would just proceed with these kind of practices, which are not suitable for me. I'm just not there. Yeah. I just can't handle it. And, you know, I had nights of terror. I was petrified with fear. And I'm so glad that you helped me out there.
I'm so glad that you're able to be humble enough to realize it, because most people would think it's interesting, you know, and luckily you didn't get the more blissful, wonderful experiences, which a minor god would be giving you to take over. And then you'd think, oh, it's going well, you know,
yeah,
because you're a juicy meal.
Actually, you know? Even in my workshops, I also tell my students about you, because I don't do asana workshops. I'm like a tourist guide to Tantra. And tell them what is out there where you can study. And I said, I'm not a tantra teacher. Please, that's super important. I'm just a tourist guide. And if you're interested on which stage on an enlightenment awakening I am, it's stage 3, and there are 12. So
that's a wonderful stage. That's a really high. It's actually very high when you look at the population. Yeah. I'm very glad that you have that humility, that you're able to help people and take them on a tour of Tantra and let them know that it's a wonderful thing, but that you should have to approach it the right way with respect. That's really powerful, you know. Yeah.
But you have to come here so people can learn the real stuff. But we'll talk about this after our podcast.
I'm coming home, right? Because my mother's side and my grandmother and my great grandmother, they're all German. Yeah. The shamanism I learned when I was young from my, you know, and what I learned about from my great grandmother, because I never met her. She died before I was a little boy. She was German. They were all German from Bavaria. Uh-huh. So it was German shamanism. So whatever we brought over on the boat, we had. and we learned. I went back much later in my early 20s, and I studied with everybody in the area to learn what they were doing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to come home to Germany. Sure.
Yeah, I can't wait to that too.
Deutsch, yeah.
I still have questions. I mean, we are talking about 1 hour now, but is it okay when you continue?
Go all day.
Maybe I cut it in 2 parts.
Sure, that's great.
And because I also, you just mentioned the sexuality and relationship part in the beginning, and I would be also super interested, because it changed so much, I think, at this time we are living in. We are living in a time where we have dating apps like Tinder or Bumble, and and there's this super idealized romantic goal everyone was grow up with, and I was wondering what is the view on sexuality and relationship in the like a Mahasiddha tradition.
Yeah, the Mahasiddha view on sexuality and relationships is that, it take a step backwards, is that when we become fully realized in stage 7, not fully realized, but realized in stage 7. We have 5 stages to go after that for full realization as a human. But, you know,
4 stages
well realized
to come for me.
Yeah, always, right? When we become realized in stage 7, we understand an intimacy with the universe that we never had before. Mm-hmm. We understand an intimacy with nature that we didn't know was even possible, you know, maybe heard intellectually. So honestly, the path to me has always been, and a slang term for our path is the path of ultimate intimacy. The path of ultimate intimacy is what a lot of my masters would refer to our whole path. And this was Shaivists and Dzogchenpas and Taoists. They would all say in the end, their own word from their language for intimacy, I'm translating into English. So they would say this path is actually the path of being completely intimate with everything and everyone. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, how beautiful. Not on a physical level, of course, but on a real spiritual level. So within that understanding developed in each one of these traditions that I named, and we keep it in the Mahasiddha tradition, the path of mirror consorts. And here it means you find a relationship partner to practice with during your lifetime so that you can realize ultimate intimacy with another human being as a gateway into ultimate intimacy with the universe. So first, ultimate intimacy with yourself. Like you said, stage three, that's what you're doing now. And that's the absolute foundation. And so difficult to achieve stage three. I applaud your effort. It's wonderful. Amazing. Amazing. I'm going to, you know, shower of flowers coming out of heaven now all over you. And then we go to ultimate intimacy with another being. Should we be lucky enough to find another being willing to go that route with us? But that's the thing. In the old days, is you had enough people practicing in your tradition, in your religion, your tradition, that you would have so many partners who wanted to be your partner through life, to practice as a yogini, yogi partner, mirror consorts. We call them mirror consorts because you mm-hmm. see essence in each other.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then when you do that, you go through and you see essence with the universe. This is also the foundation of what's called guru yoga, or the tradition of why we take a guru. We want that same intimacy. Not with the guru's personality. Yeah, it's nice to know a guru. You get along with them. You can maybe have a beer if they're that kind of a guru. But it's not intimacy with their personality we're seeking, or intimacy even with their knowledge, intellectual knowledge. Certainly not intimacy with their physical body through sexuality that we're seeking. If we're seeking that, we've lost the plot. But really what we're seeking with the guru is intimacy with their essence nature, which is the same type of essence nature as our essence nature. They're both the same. Same experience. That's the intimacy we want. So that's in guru yoga as well, you see. So we're always seeking intimacy, because my guru said to me, if you can love one person unconditionally, just teach yourself, train yourself to love one person unconditionally, then you will love everyone, and then you will love the universe, and then you will be that love. In other words, you'll be enlightened. Beautiful, right?
That's really beautiful.
So beautiful. And so he said, look, and that's why we practice guru yoga. I'm the only person in your life who doesn't want something from you except your enlightenment. The only thing I want from you is your enlightenment. Even your mother wanted something from you, like good grades in school, you know, or get a good job or get a good wife mm-hmm. or give me a grandchild. You know, as much as our parents love us, they're conditional. They have conditions on us. This is the main characteristic of a true guru. They have no condition on you. They only want your liberation, your enlightenment. They may use whatever method they use in their system, but they are only wanting your liberation. There's nothing you're giving them that they intrinsically need or want from you. Now, when we take that approach into guru yoga, we become enlightened. It's the foundation of all tantra is guru yoga, intimacy. Now, take it back into the mirror consorts and your question of sexuality. The greatest path, I think, honestly, I say this quite honestly, the two greatest paths for modern people, I think, are the Mahasiddha teachings and practices through two ways. We have five ways in Trikamasiddha Yoga. One of them is called the way of the warrior. Mm-hmm. That's one of the best ways for modern people for many, many reasons, but I won't go in it now. But so few people can do it because maybe they're too old or their body's not healthy anymore to do warrior training and so forth. Or they just have no interest. The other one that I think is the best for human beings today, and I think could save the planet if we all got into it, is the way of mirror consorts. It's one of the five ways, and I think it's the best. But it has a lot of prerequisites, and especially finding a partner who will go the whole route with you is tricky. Mm-hmm. And it demands, it's a very demanding practice. It's extremely demanding because you're in it 24/7 because you're with your partner that you live with 24/7. Mm-hmm. So it's not a practice where you can get away from it. I meditate 3 hours a day, and then the other times of the day, I come in and out of awareness. I come in and out of being compassionate. I come in and out of being wise. No. You get no break because your partner will ride you like a pony. You will, you know, you will have to show up 24 hours a day as a realized being, you know, and that's the trick. Mm-hmm. But because of that, it is such a beautiful path. It is so powerful, and it reveals our nature so powerfully. And it involves all levels of intimacy, spiritual, psychic, mental, emotional, and physical. Mm-hmm. And the physical part then refers to the sexualized yoga practices you can do together. So there's straight out lovemaking that has a sexual rules, we could say, that turned it into mirror consort training. And please, listeners, don't confuse this with Neo Tantra. It's not Neo Tantra. Mm-hmm. It's very different. I don't even want to talk about that. But there are practices that use the sexual energy, but not as an energy like to get powerful outside of anything other than the true love and intimacy of the partners. Mm-hmm. There are sexual practices that use the love and intimacy of the partners to reveal the true nature of a human being. And these are sequential, progressive, and they're built upon and founded upon emotional, mental stability, emotional, mental training in the tradition, prayers, meditations. In fact, in the mirror construct training, one of the requirements is that if you're going to be able to hold your mind together during sexuality, you have to have an established meditation practice. And the usual requirement was an everyday meditation practice for 10 years. So you have a partner that you can trust, you have a meditation practice for 10 years, and you've made a lifetime commitment to monogamy with that person. So right away, that pretty much eliminates most people that would want to try this today, because non-monogamy is so popular today and people find it hard to find partners. But anyway, sexuality being the core energy, right, of our central channel. So can I backtrack a minute and explain a bit of energy physiology?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Our central channel has four components to it. We call Sushumna Nadi in Sanskrit, right? Mm-hmm. Madhyapata, so the middle path in Sanskrit, many different names for it, the Vajra, whatever. So, but here's what it means. The energy of the central channel is not uniform. It has different frequencies, different vibrational levels, if you will, different levels of consciousness, if you want to call it that. There's the outer one, the outer level. That's the most basic. It feeds the physicality. It feeds the emotions and the mind, mm-hmm. all that. The mental mind, and intellectual mind, like chakra number three mind. And then you have the next layer in. The next layer in is the layer of the diversity of the potentiality of all energetic diversity. And it's called Chitranadi, and it's diverse, right? So Chitra means in this case diverse. And it is, what can I say, the non-dual potentialities of all things that come into manifestation are related to that level. The next vibrational frequency level in, is called Vajranadi. Vajranadi is seen as a red channel inside the blue channel. And it's a very unique one because it doesn't go just from the Muladhara chakra to Sahasra, the way we usually visualize a central channel. And for your listeners who don't know classical tantra from the oral practice tradition, which is much older than the textbooks they've been reading, if they're attending tantra courses and reading textbooks about tantra from modern writers, the central channel goes out the crown above the head, and it goes down through the legs into the earth. And there are chakras that are outside the body that are along these channels called the extra bodily chakras. But anyway, I come to Germany, I'll explain all that.
Yes,
so,
that would be great.
Right. So this Vajra Nadi, this red nadi, is different than the other parts of Sushumna central channel in a very interesting way, in that it terminates, or it has an extension that goes out the male penis, follows out the male penis. Actually, male penis grows in the embryo around this nadi, to say it properly. Mm-hmm. The nadi is not going, pushing into the penis. The penis grows around the nadi. And it goes out to the head of the penis, to a marma. Mm-hmm. On the very amarma point, you know, marma points, I think, right? Little energy points on the body.
I didn't know the word, but I have the picture. And
We touch them when we do nyasa, when we put the deity's energy in the body with mantras. So that one's on the end of the penis. And that is an interesting thing to think about. Part of your central channel is projected outside your body into the head of your penis. And then for a woman, another branch comes off and goes to the central channel passes through the G spot. That's mm-hmm. what we believe in Mahasiddha Yoga. But then another small channel shoots off from that and goes out to the clitoris. Mm-hmm. So we have these connections that when we make love as a human being, actually the central channels touch, the central channels mix. Let me get on that mm-hmm. for 1 second. I'll come back to that in a second. Because the last nadi down the very center of the Vajranadi is the Brahmanadi. And the Brahmanadi is the Nadi of pure blue sky color, lapis lazuli blue sky, and is the pure energy of our essential nature. So, Sandra, this becomes a very powerful thing to discuss, because when our two nadis are touching, male and female, we are now in an exchange. And, we're in an exchange. And I see a lot of things, actually, just this week. It's kind of an interesting thing, because yeah, we're here, we are talking about this. I saw this come up a lot on Facebook threads, where people are saying, is it true that we share each other's karmas when our central channels connect in sex? Is it true? Is it true? I think I was the first person talking about this stuff, honestly, way back in the 80s. And it's now getting very popular. And I think it's really important that people understand this too. You do plug into each other when it happens, when your central channels touch. It's not only when you're in love and there's intimacy. That, of course, creates a deeper exchange in some ways and more channel connection. But any kind of sexuality, any kind, even when you're kissing, there's a soft, subtle, small nadi that goes in the tongue, which reproduces a central channel in its form in the tongue. So even when you start kissing, you start exchanging energy already. But by the time your genitals link, male-female genitals link, you exchange it. So are you getting karma from other people? Yes. Are you sharing their karmic world? Yes. Simple way to put it would be this. Let's say, Sandra, you're vibrating at a level 8. Let's say there's 10 levels, and you're vibrating at 8, really high, doing your good spiritual work. And then you go on Tinder, or you meet some dude at the pub, or even you meet a nice colleague, you know, and start developing something. But no matter how nice they are, they're not deeply into spiritual work yet, and they're vibrating at 5. Mm-hmm. Okay. They have a lot more of psycho-emotional stuff to process out, right? Right. Then you start making love, your central channels connect. You're going to end up, you know, moving from 7 and he's 5. You're going to end up at, you know, 6, 5.5. It's going to bring you down and it's going to raise him up, potentially raise him up. At least while you're making love, the potentiality is to raise him up. But you will start to diminish yourself, and you will not be increasing your vibration level, let's say. And but how does this show
are
up?
If you are in love with someone, who is, let's say, vibrating on a level of 5 or even less? And is it also okay in their tradition to say, okay, I know that that I will vibrate lower, but I love this person and I want to go this way, and I double my practice, or I don't know which way you could go, because when you fall in love, you fall in love.
Yeah. You wear the extra thick spiritual condom, I think is what you're looking for.
But you have to wear it over the tongue as well, because you said
repels all the bad. Yeah.
Because you exchange it by kissing.
The tongue condom, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's a tricky thing, you know, when you're married already, or you're already in a committed monogamous relationship, and you get into the spiritual teachings. And I'm always shy to give these teachings publicly, because people say, oh, you just ruined my life, you know, ruined my day. And I said, look, the fact that this is a truth doesn't mean that you have to die to it right now. This is a truth. There's ways to work with it. The main thing is our partner a really good person? Are they a really good human being?
Yeah, because you said this in my Nadi reading, that this is what I should look for. And it was, you know, when you said the sentence in my, and a Nadi reading is an astrological reading, and I did a whole podcast episode about this. It opened up my heart. It was like a flower who opened up, and you know, sometimes you hear sentences and truth, and they resonate on such a deep level, and you just know it's the truth, you know. So I love that this was your advice. But sorry, I interrupted you. I got enthusiastic again.
No, I love it. Yeah, no, I love that you bring that up, because yes, it is. It's the most important thing in choosing a partner. This is number one. Are they a good person? Now, sometimes we get with a person and we're with them 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever, we have kids already, and we're like, oh God, they're not really a good person. You know, I mean, they're my wife, my husband, but I'm like, you know, they're a little racist, or they've actually got a mean streak, or, you know, whatever. They're into weird stuff, and who knows? You discover all this stuff over time. And that's a shame, because, you know, that's the main characteristic that we need as a mirror consort on an energetic level. That our consort, our husband and wife, must be a good person, a good human being. And if they're not, what I'd suggest is that the person, you know, involved with them, you get them into the outer level of the teachings. Like in Trikamasada Yoga, the outer B, study the precepts, the 21 precepts of human conduct. So when a human being is realized, they conduct themselves in 21 ways, very clear in the teaching that we have. And you can find that document on the Facebook group, Trikamasada Yoga Facebook group, right? And it describes it in great detail. So you can sit down and have talks with your partner about it, make it a tea time discussion, keep it part. So the person starts evolving. They start changing their character, becoming a better person. Or they could even start to do the prayers of the Shakta Shaiva Foundation practice. If they're not anti-religious or anti-spiritual practice, they start doing the prayers and reading those prayers daily and really thinking about them. They sink into your consciousness. They start to change you. People can become a better person. They can start to watch their conduct, which is really important. You can say, you can teach your partner, look, hey, Michael, there's body, speech, and mind. There's the way your body conducts itself in the world mm-hmm. with other people, and there's the way you think, and there's the way you feel. The speech means how you feel and how you speak. So why don't you think about it all day long to try to be compassionate or joyous or be in a state of equanimity or a state of love, let's say. You know, one of the four immeasurables I just named. So if we keep those in our mind, our behavior changes and we become a better person.
Mm-hmm. I'm just speechless, you know, because it's so beautiful. And I think it has so much value what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. It does.
It's beautiful that you're sharing this.
So we can all get there. Our partners can get there. And I think if you're with a partner who's a bad person, you might want to consider, you know.
I have another question.
Something else.
What if a partner does have another religion? Uh-huh. Because I just had an interview with someone who is a tantrika and does have a marriage and she is Christian.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. I used to teach that man.
I know we were talking about you. He said like you were his teacher. Because I was quoting you by, and I love this quote, when you were asking in this talk, what does it mean when you have all this incredible energy sensations in your body and this amazing experiences? What does it mean? It means nothing. I told him this and he said, yeah, I studied with him too.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy. And I remember him having, you know, working with that. Yes, my wife's a Christian and I'm a Taka. How does this work? And again, it's about, is the person a really good person? And I guess now you bring up this point. You bring up a very good point, Sandra. Is the person open-minded? Does the person also from their religion realize that the whole purpose of religion is to make you a good person? So if you marry a tantrika who's a really good person, well, if you're a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, a Sikh, or whatever, a Baha'i, whatever you are, that should tell you that you're with the right person, that's enough, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but if you're a good, pretty good person, but you hold into the religious dogma of your fundamentalism too much, and you think, well, I'm a Christian and I'm a good person and my husband's a tantrika, he's a good person, but he's going to hell because he's not saved. He doesn't take Jesus as the Lord and Savior of the universe, the only one, everything else is bad, he's going to hell, you know, then you have a serious problem. So as long as your partner thinks you're a good person and that's the highest their religion points to, I mean, let's be clear about it for Christians. Everybody who's listening right now, you don't know this about my history, but I was so into spirituality and so into my early religion. Even though I pursued Eastern things simultaneously, I was pursuing becoming a priest in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So that when I was 15, I went off to a special school called Seton Hall. The first American saint, Mother Seton, developed this school and it continued. And I was being trained to be in pre-seminary so that when I graduated high school, I was going to go into the seminary and be a priest. So I know the Catholic catechism dogma really well. And I know all the other Christian sects that aren't cults. I know their tradition really well too. And here's the thing. Jesus, in the Bible that we have, and there are over 200 other books that were never published that were about him that he gave great teachings in, but even in the books that we have right now, he himself said, I come here to complete the law of all that Ten Commandments stuff. Stop guilting yourself, basically, he was saying. Stop being shamed, stop being guilty. All that's the tribal stuff, we don't need it anymore. He said, I come here to complete the law. And he said, there's only two things. There's only two great commandments, he said. They replace everything. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now that's compassion. Right away, that's unconditional love. Yeah. That's the highest virtue, and that's what realization in Tantra is. And then he said, love your God with all your heart, soul, and your mind. And, you know, we don't have a God in Tantra. The whole universe is God to us. There is no a being. There is no Shiva. That's some person pulling strings up there. So it's all just pure loving awareness. And so he was giving tantric teachings, basically, as the two highest realizations of a tantrika is pure loving awareness. And if you take loving awareness, love and awareness to the highest level, you rainbow light body. So if a Christian really understands the teachings of Jesus, if he says, well, this is what you need, not that you need to be baptized, not that you need to take my name and do some funny ritual, but these are the two highest teachings. He himself gave those two highest teachings. If you're a good person, you're doing those things already. You know, even if you don't think there's a God, you love all beings. And that is God. That is loving awareness. All beings are God. So therefore, you are in that alignment anyway. So that's how I think about it, Sandra.
I think that's maybe the most important thing for everyone, or to become a person with a good heart.
Yes, yeah, so
and to
important.
Become a good person.
Oh, totally. This is it. This is the path. And all these exercises we do are, you know, spiritual sadhana, spiritual exercises are to express our divinity. They're not really to discover it. Discovering it happens by grace. Discovering it happens by reading more and, you know, talking more. It's a process. But really what the practices are about are expressing that inner beauty, that inner oneness that we are, that Buddha nature, that nature of mind, that Shiva nature, whatever you want to call it. And that's the beauty of it. Now, if we're really doing our practices and expressing that, then we become a good person. We become a good human being.
I think that's the perfect ending for this podcast, but I still have questions. So you need to come back.
Okay.
We have to do a second episode.
Okay. We'll do it.
But just in short, and I will put everything in the show notes. So if you read the description of this podcast, you will find all the links. But also you might want to share where we can study with you, or maybe the most important website.
Share that now? Right now our website is being developed, and it's 4 to 6 weeks away, and it will be called, you'll find it www.trikamahasiddhayoga.com, trikamahasiddhayoga.com. And right now we have a Facebook group that we announce all this in, and I give teachings on, and it's also Trika Mahasiddha Yoga Facebook group, Trika Mahasiddha Yoga, three words. That's a good one to start with as well. One more thing, if you don't mind me saying, Sandra, is that we have the video teaching. Thank you. We have a lot of the video teachings up on YouTube, Trika Mahasiddha Yoga YouTube channel. So until we have the website up and people can actually log on and take courses with us through the website, online learning for the prerequisites, they can go through and start to study right away with all the other videos and the documents on the Facebook group and all the other things. So thank you for that. We want to really let people know about the tradition so they can start to get going and help themselves with it. It's our whole mission. I've done nothing but teach pretty much for the last 30 years. Both of my gurus have asked me to do this, to preserve the tradition and share it. So we'd love it nothing more for it to be available to people. You know, if it's your cup of tea, we're here to help you.
And I personally can recommend to study with you so much. If anyone wants to have an opinion or if they are interested in sharing hearing my experience, I'm happy to do so. You are amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad and happy that I met you. And I'm very, very honored and thankful and grateful for you.
Well, thank you. And everything that I share with you, it only comes to you because I've had the greatest masters. It's all about them. It's all about them bringing their beauty through to us so we can benefit still. And that's why we got to keep it going. So all praise to the masters. Thank you for their wonderful guidance and protection. May everybody hearing this podcast and all of us all continue to be guided and protected on our path. And may we get to full realization in this lifetime. Tathastu. May it be so.
May it be so.
If you like this podcast, we would be super happy if you would rate us on Apple Podcasts or if you give us a follow on Apple iTunes or on Spotify. We want to say thank you for listening to House of Grace and wish you all the best, and hopefully you listen to us soon.